everybody. Welcome to the best in true crime podcasting. This is True Crime Tuesday, and we've got a great interview lined up for you today. Now, I want to make a mention. You'll get the entire interview. The only segment of today's show you won't hear is our Dumb Crimes, Stupid Criminals. Why? Because that's under Stitcher Premium. We want to make sure that everybody gets a chance to hear these remarkable interviews of these incredible true crime stories. But for only $5 a month, you can subscribe to Stitcher Premium. That'll give you the entire episode. That includes the entire interview you're about to hear, plus Dumb Crimes, Stupid Criminals, and every episode of Darkness Radio, the best in paranormal podcasting. All 1,000-plus episodes commercial-free. And if that's still not enough reason for you to want to subscribe, you don't just get True Crime Tuesday and Darkness Radio, which, let's face it, for $5 a month, that's pretty valuable. You get every other show underneath the Stitcher umbrella. That means hundreds of thousands of hours of your favorite type of podcast programming commercial-free. Nobody got time for commercials. So if you're interested, then make sure you go subscribe now to Stitcher Premium. Use code word Darkness Radio, all one word, Darkness Radio, for some deep discounts for an entire year's savings. Go do that right now. Take advantage of the special and be able to listen to Darkness Radio, True Crime Tuesday, and all of the other amazing programs across Stitcher's platform. Go subscribe right now. Sit back, relax, and enjoy this episode of True Crime Tuesday. Hello and welcome. You're tuned into the best in true crime talk radio. This is True Crime Tuesday. I'm your host, Dave Schrader, along with me, the one and only Mr. Tim Dennis. Hello, Tim.
Hey there.
We've got a guest joining us today, Tim. John Wingate will be here with us in just moments. We're going to cover two of his books. His first book came out in December of 2017, Lost Boys of Hannibal, Inside America's Largest Cave Search. And then we're going to discuss his newer book, Souls Speak, which is a sequel to that book. These are not novels. These are actual books about true crime, a follow-up book, if you will. Missing Children Reveal Their Serial Killer from Beyond. That is the topic of the second book, where we might get some interesting insights to this case. We just talked about a case last week on the show, Tim, on Darkness Radio, about the young boy and his family that were out on vacation, and this three-year-old started talking about a dead woman he could see, and the fact that she needs their help, and he described this woman. And this case is crazy, guys. If you have not heard this case, as a matter of fact, let's do this. We'll go ahead and we'll play that audio right here.
We turn now to a family vacation that took a strange turn in California. They visited the same area where a missing woman was last seen. ABC's Andrea Fuji picks up the story from there.
This morning, a California family's ghostly encounter could help solve a mystery. When the Gorba family went on a four-wheeling trip in the Sierra National Forest, their three-year-old son, Caden, started talking to someone who wasn't there.
He was just in our car, and he was pointing out to a certain spot in the meadow.
The family was at Shut Eye Peak, about 70 miles outside Fresno, when they stopped for lunch. Mom, Victoria, says Caden told them there was a woman close by.
I got goosebumps. He says, she needs our help, but she's dead. And she's laying face down with her legs up, and she can't talk to me, but she's over there. We need to go help her.
Caden's parents checked out the meadow, but saw nothing.
He kept saying, trust me, Mom. And I was like, I trust you, bud. You know, I believe you 100%.
Creeped out, the Gorbas said they headed back home. Caden's mom then posted their experience on social media, and that's when the Madera County Sheriff's Department reached out for more information. Turns out, a woman went missing just over a year ago within 5 miles of where they were, a woman with a black shirt and blue hair.
He describes down to blue hair. He said she has a black shirt, blue jeans, and blue hair, Mom.
Detectives say Caden's description matched that of 53-year-old Sandra Hughes, who went missing in June 2020 after going camping alone. Caden was able to identify 3 out of 4 pictures of her. Detectives went back to the meadow with the Gorba family to investigate, and so far found nothing. But the case remains open.
If she was possibly a ghost looking for some help, I hope that he could have at least helped and maybe helped the family find her.
That four-wheeler the family used to drive up to the meadow is now for sale. They say they're too spooked to use it again. Mona, Victor.
Andrea, thank you. And now we both have the chills.
Yeah. See, that is one of the strangest stories I've heard. I can't even tell you in how long, Tim. And to have that much detail that the kid could not only see this girl, this woman that had gone missing and murdered, they suspect, but could identify her in photographs matching the woman that went missing, that's pretty uncanny. So the concept of the soul reaching out from beyond to try to seek help in their death is not out of the way. I mean, we've heard these type of stories before, just like I said, but this one was just recent and has been sent to us probably 1,000 times by listeners around the world. Interesting case. That's why I thought this was going to be an interesting topic to cover both books in this conversation, and how voices from beyond might be trying to help crack this case. John Wingate, our guest again today. John is a Minneapolis-based writer, or he was, an author and communications consultant, a former consumer reporter for KSTP-TV. He spent 20 years as a broadcast journalist in Illinois and Minnesota, a career path that captured his interest at age 13 during the 1967 cave search for the Lost Boys of Hannibal. He has garnered nearly 20 awards for writing and reporting excellence, including 3 National Telly Awards for screenwriting and video production. John was born in Hannibal, Missouri, and he spent his early childhood years there. John, thank you so much for coming back and spending some time with us.
Dave, it's good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Lost Boys of Hannibal. Let's start the episode and let's talk about the case from 1967 surrounding this story. And you grew up in Hannibal, so were you there during this missing case, or was this just something you heard about as you got older?
Well, I was born and raised during my childhood years in Hannibal, and in May 10th of 1967, when this whole calamity began, we were living in nearby Quincy at the time. But growing up, I was friends with 2 of the 3 lost boys of Hannibal. Joel Hoag, who was 13, his brother Billy, who was 11, and then I did not know their neighbor, Craig Dowell, who was 14 years old, the third boy that went missing in May of 1967.
So you knew 2 of these boys and knew them well. Set up the feel for us in 1967. What was it like in Hannibal, Missouri? What were the people like? What was the time like? And what was the crime like in that era?
Well, everyone knows Hannibal as the boyhood home of Samuel Clemens, who wrote under the pen name of Mark Twain. And growing up in Hannibal, this was before iPads and such, young children, especially the boys, played outdoors in the woods all day during the summer and spring and fall. And it was a pastoral, quiet town, and this was amidst tumultuous era. The Vietnam War was raging, and the hippie movement was well underway, centered in Haight-Ashbury. So it was a time of peace and love and terrible violence of war. But in Hannibal, we were kind of immune from all that, and it was a wonderful place to spend your childhood. And much of the time, we were modern-day Tom Sawyers and Huckleberry Finns out in the woods, looking for fossils or snakes or lizards or whatever would capture our imagination on a summer afternoon. So it was a wonderful time to grow up. Some years ago, I was visiting Hannibal, and this was probably spring of 1999. And I was standing atop Lover's Leap, which is the 300-foot high bluff that serves as the town's most prominent geologic feature. And the view is simply spectacular up and down the Mississippi. The tall buildings of Quincy, Illinois, 17 miles upstream, are visible. You look out over the rich Illinois river bottom land that produces robust corn and soybean yields. And below is the pastoral town of Hannibal itself, looking like a picture postcard. And I recall the day more than 5 decades earlier when I was playing on this very spot with Joel Hoag and another friend, Gary Rush. And we would always go up to Lover's Leap and follow a narrow dirt path down the side of the steep hill into a sheltered area. And there we would drink in the spectacular views of the town and the river and tell stories and shoot our BB guns and slingshots. And Recalling that moment some years ago, I remembered that that was the last time I ever saw Joel Hoag. Well, what had brought me to Lover's Leap on that windy spring day was a simple granite marker that had been placed there in memory of the three lost boys whose adventures simply ended too soon. And it's a gravestone, really, because no one, even today, can be absolutely certain what happened to Joel and Billy and Craig Dowell on May 10th of 1967. All we do know is that about 5:15 p.m., that was the last time they were ever seen. And as the boys' mothers called them for dinner, there's no sign of them. No boys came running with dusty sneakers. The three boys had simply vanished.
Jeez. Just and had there been other mysterious reported vanishings of children in and around that area before or even after that?
There were a couple of boys in nearby Monroe City, Missouri, which is 15 miles from Hannibal. And these boys vanished after the Lost Boys of Hannibal disappeared. And they were John Wagner, who went missing in February of 1968, and Ricky Enox, who vanished in June of 77. Both of these boys, as we'll go into later in this story, had kind of a signature look that all of Gacy's victims had, kind of dark hair, kind of what you'd consider cute for their age, you know, and just good kids and a little naive, perhaps. So in May of 1967, progress was on the march in Hannibal. They were building or extending a new state highway, 79, from the southern edge of Hannibal southward towards St. Louis. And they had to remove an entire hill, just millions and millions of cubic feet of dirt by dynamiting it for a couple of weeks. And in doing so, had exposed a subterranean cave network of incredibly complex maze caves. Now, for background, it's important to note that Missouri is called the Cave State, with more than 7,000 caves identified to date and about 100 more being identified every year. So it wasn't unusual to find caves in Hannibal growing up, but we were usually pretty cautious and would not go into them very deeply. But once the three boys of Hannibal saw these caves excavated, they couldn't help themselves, and they ran across the dusty construction zone and jumped down into these openings and would spend an hour or so exploring them. And they did this for two evenings before they vanished. And when they came out of these subterranean cave networks, they ran home and they were muddy and dusty, and their parents gave them a good talking to, warning them not to get near the construction site and certainly not to go into any cave openings that they found. Well, on May 10th, 1967, there was a school
day. But John, isn't that kind of just narcotics to little children? I know growing up in Illinois, I certainly didn't have as many dangerous places to go investigate, but we had this crazy rock quarry that was blown out and an old abandoned amusement park. I mean, it was total Scooby-Doo headquarters for us. And, you know, hiding and going on and realizing now as an adult, this is stuff I would be absolutely livid with my children doing and going to. But you tell a kid, stay away from that, and everybody's going to head in that direction, right? I mean, so just because the parents and everybody's warning them, is that enough to keep the kids from wanting to go and be, you know, Tom and Huck and go in just a little deeper, just find, you know, some majesty and you know, adventure just a little beyond where anybody else had gone before.
Right. It was experiential narcotics, you know,
yeah.
A boy couldn't help himself. And when they jumped into these openings, they were just astonished. They had a dim flashlight and they found that in some areas, the ceiling was about 10 or 12 feet high. And then some of the passages were very narrow and low, where you'd have to get on hands and knees to crawl through them. But they were just absolutely transfixed. And, you know, this wasn't a man cave. It was like literally a boy cave for them. And they were quite happy and, in fact, giddy with their new discovery. So on May 10th, the boys had gone to school and then made plans to go back to the cave network that afternoon. And they were seen in the area of Murphy's Cave, which was about a mile south, no, actually about three blocks south of the construction zone. And this long known cave had an opening exposed during the road construction as well. And Murphy's Cave is a complex of 2 miles of passageways packed into about a 10-acre footprint that sits below an actual rock quarry, as you mentioned, in the neighborhood that I grew up in Hannibal. So it was a place of grand adventure.
And, you know, were there many times that children would go in those caves and get lost and it would require help from law enforcement or the locals to go in and find these children?
Historically, I found that there were two incidents, one known to the press and one unknown to the press. In 1874, when Murphy's Cave was first discovered by a workman digging for clay to make bricks, he discovered a cave opening, and shortly the other neighborhood kids discovered it as well. And about six or eight little kids went in to explore and got terribly turned around in this maze cave. And the alarm was sounded, and some fathers lit their lanterns and went in looking for them. And they were in there about 12 hours, and finally about midnight, they heard a faint voice from a distant passageway, and the fathers made their way there on hands and knees, and there they were huddled together trying to stay warm in the 53-degree environment. So that was the first time that some children had disappeared, so to speak, in the cave, but luckily that story had a happy ending. We fast forward to June of 1961, when three Owen boys, who lived on the south side of Hannibal, discovered an opening to Murphy's Cave that had a 55-gallon drum packed into the entrance to keep kids from going in. And of course, that was just an incentive for them to pull the barrel out and go in and have a look. And they got into this network and went further and further back, and they had a ball of string so they could find their way out eventually. But eventually the ball of string ran out, and the boys unwisely kept going. And at some point they realized that they were terribly turned around. And you have to understand that in these maze caves, everything looks essentially the same. It's kind of a tan, buff Louisiana limestone with clay floors. And the openings are very narrow, the ceiling's low, moving is very slow through there. And it's not unlike being in a cornfield at night. If you'd walk into a cornfield and someone would turn you around and tell you to find your way back to the car, you know, what direction do I go? You know, it's impossible to find your way out without some reference from the sun or whatever. So these kids were fairly calm and did not panic, and just thought it through and essentially made their way out and emerged about 7 p.m. at night. And a couple of days later, their mother discovered their adventure and gave them a good tongue wagging, and they promised never to go in again. So this was June of 61, just about the time John Kennedy was pledging us to go to the moon by the end of the decade. And the three Owen boys saw themselves as grand adventurers too, but that was short-lived after the cave adventure.
Oh, man. All right. I'm luckily where I grew up, nobody that I'm aware of ever went missing or hurt in the quarry or the old abandoned amusement park, but just the intoxicating effect of these, you know, magical places to kids, right? To go in and be a part of these areas and you know, just adventure away and have fun and play. And it was a perfect playground. So I can only imagine what that would be like out in Hannibal. And I mean, there's some strange legends and stories as well. Wasn't there not to get too far off topic, but wasn't there a famous doctor, McDowell or something, whose daughter had died very young, and he kept her in a pickle jar in one of those, or like a pickle barrel in one of those caves at some point?
Yes, he was quite an odd character. He was from St. Louis, and he was doing research into ways to preserve a human body naturally. And his daughter died of cholera, I believe, and suddenly he had a victim to experiment on. So he hung her in a glass container full of alcohol inside what is now Mark Twain Cave. And Mark Twain writes about this, and he and his buddies used to go in to the cave and in a very macabre way, take the lid off this glass vial and grab the girl by the hair and pull her up. And it's really dark. And after parents in the area discovered that the boys were doing this, they made it off limits and the girl's body was removed. But yeah, some very unusual things happened. So once the boys went missing on May 10th, 1967, police were called initially, and they showed up in their uniforms and, you know, patent leather shoes and no caving experience. So they called in the Mark Twain Emergency Squad, which likewise had no real caving experience, and they were most commonly pulling bodies out of the river or looking for lost hunters out in the forests. So by late evening of May 10th, 1967, they contacted some cavers in Quincy, who coincidentally was gathered at one of the members' houses having their monthly meeting. And they were astonished by the police call and quickly gathered their gear and headed south to Hannibal. And they made the first forays into Murphy's Cave about 10:30 or 11 that night. Well, they found nothing, no evidence of the boys. And by Thursday morning, May 11th, the call had gone out, and cavers from St. Louis and elsewhere in Missouri and Illinois were motoring to Hannibal to join the search. And some of these individuals were among the best cavers in the country. And they numbered at the height of the search probably over 100. And they went through Murphy's Cave and then the road cut where the construction zone was, hundreds of times over a 30-day period. And there was never any evidence of the lost boys, not a shoe, not a flashlight, not a, you know, sock, nothing.
And certainly no remains, no blood, nothing along those lines that would show that they may have been there at some point.
No evidence whatsoever, no bodies at all.
Okay.
And the searchers were just, you know, so frustrated because it was literally a race against time. They knew that boys in T-shirts in a 53-degree environment underground would not last long. Eventually, hypothermia would take hold and they would succumb. So on Thursday, a telex was sent by Hannibal police to the Speleological Society of America in suburban Washington, D.C. And this was an organization formed by caver William Karras in the 1960s. And his focus was to make it a search and rescue organization strictly for people lost or injured in caves. And so he assembled his team, called in a favor from a friend who worked at the Pentagon, and actually got Air Force Two to fly the team into Hannibal on Thursday night, May 11th. They hit the ground running. They landed at nearby Quincy and were in Hannibal at Murphy's Cave about 45 minutes later. And they immediately began around-the-clock searches for the boys. And Karras was kind of a flamboyant character. He liked the media. And you can understand this because he had this new organization that he was trying to promote.
Right.
So he would always be very cooperative. And some of the other cavers, cavers are kind of an insular bunch. They don't like a lot of attention. And they're very protective of caves because they don't want a lot of inexperienced people going into them and causing damage. So the cavers, in many cases, kind of resented Karras for his kind of showman techniques. But nonetheless, he was very dedicated and provided, you know, pretty good leadership for the search. And this went on day in and day out. And I remember as a 13-year-old boy going down to Hannibal at night with my father, and we would be standing there along Birch Street, which would turn into Highway 79, and just watch the cave activity and the search you know, what happened to Billy and Craig and Joel? You know, when will they be found? It was very difficult for a 13-year-old boy to even ponder that, because we had such an idyllic childhood, and all of a sudden Hannibal had a dark and ominous pall hanging over it. You know,
right.
kids aren't accustomed to having their friends vanish or die. And I remember when I first learned of the missing boys, I remember going up to bed that night and just lying there in my bed, just sobbing, praying to God, God, where are they? Please find the boys. And it was a very difficult time, and it was traumatic for many, many, many people in Hannibal and the entire area, because it just, you know, you're not accustomed to losing children. You know, we buried grandparents and aunts and uncles, but your friends are another story.
Now, behind the scenes, there had to be some whispering as to what people thought happened. What was the common theory at the time? Do you remember?
Well, there were a lot of theories, and most of them were unfounded. Some thought that the boys had run off and were hiding out somewhere because they were afraid of getting in trouble. So an extensive search was done of the islands in the Mississippi River. At one point, they checked and tracked down all of the trains that had gone through Hannibal on May 10th, 1967. And wherever they were at nationwide at the time, they were searched, and there's no evidence of any lost boys there. Some said they had run off and were out west somewhere. But these were good boys. You know, they were adventuresome, but they weren't foolish, you know, and they always came home for supper. So it was just a very odd time. And by the time early June came along, you know, nothing had been found, and Karras pulled the cavers together and said, well, you know, we're into this 3 weeks now, and it's been essentially a body recovery mission most of the time, because if they were underground, they were clearly dead. And he says, you know, how much more can we do? And the mayor of Hannibal was, you know, kind of concerned, because Hannibal is a big tourist town. Today, about 1 million people make their way there for all the Mark Twain sites and the lore. And,
right.
You know, it was another tourist season in Hannibal. So
sure.
They decided to call off the search. And at that point, the assistant state geologist for Missouri, Jerry Vineyard, and this is a man, he's now deceased. He's a friend of mine, and he was a great caver, often called the father of modern caving in Missouri. And he had come to the site after he was able to leave home, because his wife had just given birth to their daughters. So he had to stick around a few days before making his way north,
right,
from Jefferson City, if he wanted his wife to speak to him again. And he goes into the cave network and essentially confirmed everything that he was hearing from the other cavers, that these were incredibly vast caves. Just, you know, think of them as branches on a tree. You know, one would lead and then branch off in three or four directions, and you would take any one of those passages. And after a while, it would branch off in three or four directions. And many of these passageways were coffin snug, literally. So a lot of times cavers had to exhale to be able to get their torso through a passageway. I mean, it's so simply claustrophobic that I get chills even thinking about it, because I can never do that.
No way. That's crazy. I couldn't even imagine that. Well, not even at my size now, but I just, at any size, I couldn't imagine things so tight that you have to inhale or exhale in order to make your way through the system. That's a little too close for comfort.
And remember, they had done a lot of dynamiting in this area to clear the roadway through this hill. So at any given moment, as the cavers quickly discovered, collapse of a passageway was very possible because when Vineyard went in and had a look, he came out and said, there's hairline cracks throughout all the geology here. And so every caver was risking his life every time he went into these cave networks.
Jeez. Now, they're kicking over every stone they can, John. They're checking trains, they're checking the caves, they're checking everything, and there's absolutely no clue as to what happened to these kids. I mean, like you said, this has to enthrall the entire area and terrify them. Does this suddenly become a sleepy little village that now locks their doors and windows at night? What's the overall outcome to the location and to the people of the community?
Well, this quickly became a worldwide story. I have newspaper clippings from the area, from Australia, Vietnam, every major city in the U.S. I mean, it was big news, and this was before the 24-hour, news cycle. And at the time, Hannibal and Quincy had two TV stations, 7 and 10, and that was pretty much the sole source of our news. So it didn't become big news quickly, but in short order, wire service reporters made their way to Hannibal and worked out of the offices of the Hannibal Courier Post newspaper. And so it quickly became a big story. And, it was this white town drowsing, as Ron Powers wrote about. He's also a Hannibal native. This pastoral little quiet town became ground zero, for the 24-hour news cycle of the era. So it was an amazing time. And in early June, Jerry Vineyard, the assistant state geologist, finally said, look, we haven't found anything, not a single shred of evidence that the boys are in the cave. So his conjecture at the time was, well, they went into a passage that probably collapsed and buried them under tons of rubble, and which was quite a scenario to ponder because the cavers encountered many what they call breakdowns in the cave passages, areas of collapse of the ceiling. And one never knew whether this had happened a day before or 10,000 years ago. So there were so many of these breakdown areas that they simply could not dig them out in such tight quarters. So at that point, they had bad news for the families and said, we need to give up on this. And I'm really sorry. And the families carried their traumas throughout their lives. The Lost Boys' parents have all been deceased. Many of the siblings are deceased, and some are still living and still hold out hope. Well, I write a book about this, and my motivation was pure, simply to honor the Lost Boys, two of whom were friends of mine, and to also, bring this story into history so that it's not forgotten, because it was the largest cave search in U.S. history. There have been larger operations that were rescue-focused, but in these, they always know where the party is located, and it's a fairly straightforward case of going in and finding them and bringing them out if they have a broken limb or whatever. But this was the largest search in U.S. history, and interestingly, the only time where the searchers did not find the parties that they were seeking. So it's historic in that sense. So I write this book, and it's well received because so many people in Hannibal remembered it, and others were quick to learn about it and read the book. And I was in Hannibal doing a book program in June of 2018. And it was it was an oppressive day. It was 100 degrees, and the humidity, I think, was nearly as high. But 100 people had packed into the auditorium at the Mark Twain Museum there. And I was speaking to this rapt group who was very attentive to the story And in many cases, individuals had remembered the boys. And I noticed in the front row, there was a young woman in her 20s who was sobbing and her cheeks were red and her eyes were filled with tears. And while I was speaking, I thought, well, this is odd because she's, you know, not old enough to have remembered the, you know, the boys personally, but, you know, maybe she has a connection and maybe she's just emotional by the story, which it certainly was. Well, later I find out that this young woman is psychic. And this is where it becomes mind-blowing, Dave, and it simply blew my mind. But she said, while I was speaking, she sees the three boys around me. And she explained that whenever she sees something psychically, she gets emotional. She has a rush of emotion, and often she gets teary-eyed. So what she describes is the three boys standing up front with me, and they're looking at her, and one says to the other, I think she can see us. And the little boy, Billy, the 11-year-old, he moves over to her right next to her and whispers in her ear, can you see me? And, of course, she's sitting quietly in this room with 100 people and can't, you know, express what's happening to her. But it was very real and very bizarre. Well, I didn't find out about this until later through a member of the Hogue family. Meanwhile, a member of the Hogue family, a sister, had gone to a psychic in Hannibal named Brittany and had a reading some years ago in, let's see, this would be 2018. And she said nothing about her reason for the visit to the psychic, but as soon as she sat down with the psychic named Brittany. Brittany looked at her and said, your brothers are some of the lost boys. And Denise's eyes got big, Denise Hogue, and she goes, yes. And Brittany said, John Wayne Gacy killed those boys.
What?
And yes, it was just so surreal. So she goes on to do the reading, and during this reading, Brittany is saying, the three boys have come forward and they're yelling, John, 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 John Wayne Gacy, John Wayne Gacy, in unison over and over and over again. So there is no mistaking what their message was. So Brittany and Denise Hogue, the sister, were literally blown away by this. Meanwhile, the psychic who had been teary-eyed in my book event, her name was Kat Hunt, which is a pseudonym because she works in the financial industry in St. Louis and is just kind of coming into her own as a psychic and doesn't want the reputation. She sensed something terrible, too, much beyond just disappearing in a cave. She sensed a crime. And called an acquaintance of hers, another psychic who's very experienced working with police. And this woman is Mary Riley, who lives in the state of Wyoming. And Mary Riley sat down in July of 2018 and on her deck that evening and channeled this. And it was just like an explosion of photographs. And that's how Mary sees things, as if you've laid out a series of photos on a tabletop. And she, too, saw John Wayne Gacy clearly as the killer of these three boys. And at some point, Gacy came forward, she claims, and said in a snarl, yes, I killed them, but you'll never prove it. Well, she painted a picture that was absolutely astonishing. And the story she tells is that Gacy had been in Hannibal when they went missing. And at some point, he had befriended them. And he had offered them a ride that evening when they were last seen up on the road cut watching the highway construction going on and pondering whether or not to disobey their parents and go into the road caves again. So one of the boys, Craig, had to get home by 6 o'clock because that's when the church bus was going to pick him up to take him to the Wednesday evening youth meeting at a church across town. So, you know, the clock was ticking. She claims that Gacy got them in his car, started driving, and turned onto River Road, which is this little used, kind of dark and overgrown road that goes below Lover's Leap, which is on the other side of the hill from the highway construction, if you can picture this. And when you're on River Road, the Lover's Leap road cut is on one side, the Mississippi River and the railroad tracks are on the other. So once Gacy turns his car onto the River Road, the boys kind of start panicking and saying, "You're going the wrong way, you're going the wrong way." At this point, Gacy pulls what one of the psychics described as a white cloth out from behind him and puts it over the mouth of Craig Dowell, who is sitting in the front passenger seat. Craig quickly becomes disoriented and goes out, and it's clear that Gacy had used chloroform to disable Craig Dowell. At this point, the two Hogue boys in the back seat panic and start trying to get out of the rear passenger door, and they find that it's jammed. In the meantime, Gacy has pulled over the car, has gotten out with the club, and opened the driver's side rear passenger door, pulled Joel Hogue out, clubbed him and knocked him unconscious and put him in the trunk. Pulled Billy Hogue out, knocked him unconscious, put him in the trunk. The boys are completely in shock and traumatized, of course, during all of this. And he proceeds south, but only 2 miles, because at that point he's beyond the highway construction zone and rejoins Highway 79 for a short distance, where he turns off on a rutted dirt road into the forest just north of the entrance to the cement plant. Now, the cement plant was built in the early 1900s in Hannibal and is well known because they provided the cement for the Panama Canal and the Empire State Building and such. So it's a real industry fixture in Hannibal. Well, this area where Gacy pulled off is just north of the entrance to the cement plant. There's a small meadow, and then further in today, there's a cave. And according to psychic Mary Riley, a forest. And according to psychic Mary Riley, Gacy pulls in. He had pre-dug a grave at this point in the woods and pulls Craig Dowell out, gets him down, sodomizes him, and strangles him with a rope, throws his body into the hole first. He then proceeds with incredible demonic focus to the back of the car, opens the trunk, pulls out Joel Hogue, who is just now coming to, brings him out roughly, sodomizes him, suffocates him, and throws him in the hole. And Joel Hogue goes in second. Then he goes back and pulls out little Billy Hogue, who's still unconscious, and he beats him about the head and doesn't sexually molest him, but simply suffocates him. And Billy's the third to go into the grave on top. So it's Craig on the bottom, Joel, and then Billy. At that point, it is about 8 p.m. on May 10th, 1967. The boys are dead and buried just as the largest cave search in U.S. history is starting to get underway just 2 miles to the north.
Now, you hear this claim that this person's picking up on these children psychically. More people are weighing in on this. John, you know, as a journalist and somebody always seeking the truth, where do you lie in this concept as you're hearing this? Is this something you can believe? Is this just too far-fetched for you? What was it like?
Well, I'm a Christian, and, you know, the Bible is very clear about steering clear of this sort of thing, because in truth, we really cannot fully understand the nature and the dynamics of this other realm. We know it exists. We know there are demons and there are other entities, but you know, when you're dead, if you're a believer, people will say you're in heaven. So I was very conflicted initially, but there were so many odd coincidences, and especially so when I decided to bring the three women to Hannibal. I came to the conclusion that the only way to proceed with this was to test these three women. So in August and September of 2018, I brought each of them to Hannibal on separate days and drove them around Rawls County, Missouri, which is where the psychics say the boys are buried. And Rawls County is just a mile or so south from the caves where the boys were exploring and the caves that were searched, so not very far. Well, I brought Brittany Buckwalter, the first psychic who lives in Hannibal, through, and we started driving south on Highway 79, and the moment we went by that spot in the woods, just north of the cement plant entrance, she goes, "Stop, I need to go there." And she pointed into the woods. So I pull into the entrance and make an immediate right onto a white gravel road, kind of gravels, curves around into this meadow, and then there's the woods beyond. And she is so shaken. She's literally, physically shaking. And she goes, "It is so horrific what I'm seeing, what he did to the boys." So it was very clear that we had hit a hot spot. So,
So that starts to, obviously, that's awakening you to this possibility that these aren't just fakes or frauds doing something, but they're making real connections to you. Not to you, but to these boys and for this crime. John Wayne Gacy in that area, though, logically, does that stand up? Do we find that there's any proof that he would have been in and around that area?
Well, that's where the story gets even more interesting. But first, let me finish bringing the other two psychics to Hannibal.
Please, sure.
I bring Kat Hunt up, and I would consider her the least experienced of the three. She's still kind of growing into her ability. But we're driving around for an hour or two. And then at some point, we're on Highway 79 and driving near the cement plant. All of a sudden, we get to the same spot, and she goes, "Stop, there's something here." And she points over to the woods. That's number two. Two psychics have now identified the exact same area. So in September of 2018, I Mary Riley generously flies to Hannibal from Wyoming, and I drive her and her husband around. And likewise, when we're after driving around for some time, and we go up to the top of Lover's Leap, and she gets an uneasy feeling on top of Lover's Leap, and she goes, "I need to go down there." And she points down below the cliffside to River Road, which is the spot where she, you know, had seen Gacy driving the boys. So we drive down there, and she's very uneasy, and she describes the boys being very unnerved and scared. And then when we drive further south on 79 and get to that notorious spot now, north of the cement plant, she too says, "Stop, I need to go right over there in those woods." And at this point, I'm literally blown away. I don't know what to think. These are three Christian women who are honest and don't like a lot of attention for what they do, but they're very cooperative and have worked with law enforcement in the past and in a couple of cases. And so I take Mary up the gravel road into the meadow to these woods, and we get out, we walk into the woods, and she goes, And we're about 50 or 100 feet into the woods at this point. And she motions with her hands to the ground. She holds her hands out and points to the ground and says, "They're right here." And I said, "You're sure?" She goes, "They're right here." So at that point, we had full agreement that something terrible happened at this very location, and that two of the psychics saw Gacy killing the boys there, and in Mary Riley's case, burying them in the woods there. So at this point, I was starting to become a believer cautiously, and I started looking at how in the world would John Wayne Gacy be in Hannibal. And I discovered that at the time, he was living in Waterloo, Iowa. Waterloo is a four-hour drive from Hannibal. And if you're driving from Waterloo to Hannibal, you're driving on Highway 61, which goes right past Hannibal, Missouri. Well, later, just in the last year and a half, I found out from a nephew of Gacy's, a step-nephew, that Gacy frequently went to Little Rock, Arkansas to see his mother. Gacy literally adored his mother and would always drive through Hannibal and stay at the Holiday Inn on the city limits. So we put Gacy in Hannibal at that point. And I start thinking, well, how would he connect with the boys? Well, in 1967, if you're going to Little Rock from Hannibal, the route to take would be through town and south along the river, which is an incredible scenic series of vistas, and it's a very pleasant drive. I believe that he wanted to drive south along the river and cut across town, and when he drove into the South Side neighborhood, you know, it was the height of the baby boom, and there were children and lots of young boys milling about everywhere. And I think his evil nature just emerged, and he decided to spend a few days. It's interesting to note that the boys vanished on May 10th, 1967. Well, May 14th was Mother's Day, and Gacy always spent Mother's Day with his mother in Little Rock. So time-wise, it matched up. We know Gacy was going to Little Rock more than likely, and his route took him through Hannibal, Missouri.
That's remarkable. Now, you can see there's a tie that would put him through that area, but do we have any kind of records at all that would show that there was a trip during that time, that there was any way to pin him to that area, or is that still left up to, I guess, the imagination, if you will?
Yeah, well, some of it is informed conjecture based on fact, but Cook County Sheriff's Authorities have in their possession a gas receipt from Gacy from, I believe it's a short time after 1967, but it was from Louisiana, Missouri, which is a river town about 45 minutes south of Hannibal. And I believe that Gacy always liked to take routes through small towns because they didn't have, large police departments and maybe did not have a detective on staff that could handle a missing children case. And I think maybe that he was killing long before he was ever discovered in Chicago for the deaths
right.
and murders of 33 boys between 72 and 78. It's interesting that when Gacy was eventually caught, he had been killing with impunity in the Chicago area for six full mm-hmm. years
right.
before he was caught. And once he was arrested, he was being driven downtown Chicago for a court appearance, and the detective driving him looked in the rearview mirror at him in the back seat and said, "Okay, John, come clean. How many bodies? How many are there? Are there more than 33? And Gacy was a smart ass, and it was kind of smug, and he just said, "Well, I think 45 is a good number." Well, this is a very little known fact that I discovered during my research. But what's most interesting is that psychic Mary in Wyoming during her visioning of all this, had four numbers jump out at her. And the four numbers were 45, 33, 3, and 9. And I spent a lot of time pondering these numbers and what they could possibly mean. And then it struck me. It was an inspiration, I believe. Now, remember, Gacy had said to the Chicago cop, I think 45 is a good number in terms of the number of victims.
Right.
Okay, that's the 45. The 33 is the number of known victims in Chicago when he was arrested. 3 is the number of Hannibal boys that he killed. Well, 33 and 3 makes a total of 36. 36 and 45 is 9, which was the fourth number that Mary saw. And that might well represent the 9 undiscovered bodies still out there somewhere. So, you know, it's a head scratcher, but I've looked at those numbers many, many times. And initially I was looking at highway numbers and distances and that sort of thing. But these numbers seem to really kind of make sense once we put it into the context of the other facts in the case. And then later it came out during the trial that Gacy's court appointed psychiatrist said that he was clearly unable to control himself. Even today, Cook County Sheriff's Police will say, no, Gacy just killed in the Chicago area. I don't believe they want to know that he was on the loose killing for many years before he was found. In fact, Gacy's psychiatrist said he could not control himself. And in fact, once Gacy was convicted and put in jail at Menard in Southern Illinois, he took up painting. And there was a particular painting that he did of a kind of a rundown, dilapidated barn in a rural area in Arkansas. And on the back of this painting, Gacy had scrawled, "Find them if you can." So I believe that Gacy was killing for many, many years, as he would take those long drives to Little Rock, taking small town routes and killing along the way.
Now, when your mediums take you to spots and say they're here, what does that mean? Were you able to do any excavation to uncover anything, prove that they were right?
Well, at the time, I took a GPS coordinate marking for the site, and I emailed that to the Cook County or the Rawls County, Missouri Sheriff, Dinwiddie at the time, and oddly enough, the police never responded to any of my calls or emails. I was very professional and explained why I was calling, but it's almost like they did not want to hear this. And to their, benefit or credit, they're a very small sheriff's department. They have a high criminal caseload with petty drug use and such, and they don't need something like this on their radar. But in recent years, there was a change in leadership. There's a new sheriff now, and a law enforcement source has told me that they brought in ground-penetrating radar a year or so ago and found that in this particular area near the cement plant and now on cement plant property, they found that the soil had been severely disrupted. Now, ground-penetrating radar will not necessarily visualize skeletal remains, but when dirt is compacted and, in the ground, it is the ground, it has a particular signature visually when ground radar is used. And once you disrupt that pattern, the dirt never returns to that pattern again. So it's very clear to see on ground radar if a certain area of dirt ground was disrupted at some point. And this area showed a severe disruption. We also found some bones on the surface that more than likely were deer bones, because there are a lot of deer in the area. And then this year, a law enforcement source tells me they did some digging around a burn pit. And this is interesting because the bones that were found on the surface near this area had been burned. So at some point there was a burn pit there, and they dug, and they have not found anything to my knowledge to date. And what I'm not clear on is if they dug in the precise area identified by psychic Mary Riley, because she said this is where they are.
That has to be kind of exciting, again, as an investigator, somebody that has ties to this case, to get that kind of validation that there was an answer to what happened to these boys, to the general vicinity to where it took place. Why do you think more has not been done in the way to try to close this case on that? Is it because it was the use of mediums and psychics that is keeping law enforcement from taking it seriously?
I think that's one aspect, simply the fear of ridicule and the fear of coming up empty-handed. And you can understand that. You
know? Of course. Right.
And in the interim time, I've given a lot of thought of this and have kind of started looking at how long ago Gacy became twisted and, you know, how long was he killing? And I found a gentleman in Chicago who's in his 70s now, named David. And in 1959, he and his parents went to a kind of a ma and pa resort in southern Wisconsin for vacation. And while there, he was befriended by a boy working there, kind of a housekeeper, busboy kind of a role. And his name was John, and he was 15 years old. Well, John and David became fast friends in this new fun environment. There was a big lake and forest to explore. And one day John said to David, "You want to go for a canoe ride?" He said, "Sure." So they launched the canoe, and they go out under an overhanging willow tree. And there were several basking frogs sitting in the sun on this log. And David said, at a speed that was almost supernaturally fast, John pulled out a pocket knife and stabbed several of these frogs. And it was just shocking to the young boy who was in fourth grade at the time. And he couldn't believe what this boy was doing to these frogs. And then John hung them over an overhanging limb on the water and said, "Look at that. They're all dead." Well, David grew wary of John and decided to steer clear of him. Well, the next day, John comes around and says, "You want to go for a hike?" And David was wary and said, "Oh, I don't know." And John said, "Well, we'll just stay to the shoreline, and it's in clear view of the cabins. It's fine." So David agrees, and John leads him off into the kind of a treed area, and walks behind this large bush. And at that point, John quickly turns, grabs David by the shoulders, and forces him to his knees. And David suddenly says, "I feel something firm and fleshy in my mouth." And he says, it was all over in 15 seconds. And, you know, John had forced him into oral sex. And for a fourth grade boy who knew, you know, none of this, it was just a trauma, and he was in shock. And thankfully, the next day, David and his parents left the area. And shockingly, on the drive home, his mother turns to David, who's sitting in the back seat, and says, "We'll have to have that nice John come visit." And David said he was absolutely petrified that his mother would invite John to come visit them in suburban Chicago at some point. Well, fast forward, David ends up serving faithfully in Vietnam and comes home from the war with a lot of trauma. And then in the 1990s, he's watching coverage, or I'm sorry, in 1978, in December, when Gacy was arrested. It, of course, blanketed the news channels in Chicago and nationwide. And when he saw Gacy, he instantly knew that John Wayne Gacy was the John that had abused him at that camp so long ago. And so he called the Cook County prosecutor and explained the situation. And the prosecutor confirmed that, yes, when Gacy was a teenager, for a couple of summers, he worked at these small ma-and-pa type resorts in suburban Wisconsin. So at that point, you know, it's a lot of coincidence, but all the facts kind of line up.
Wow. You've got this story. You've got the background. Three independent psychic sources, mediumistic sources have come forward to confirm this story. What does this mean in total? I mean, do you think there'll ever be full justice for these boys? Obviously, Gacy's dead, but will they ever be able to do something with this? Will they be able to move with it and close this case, do you think, officially?
I'm hoping that at some point a retired police officer with the necessary skill sets that I don't have will come forward and start correlating missing boy cases and Gacy's travels back in that era. After the bulk of this story had unfolded and I was starting to write the book, Mary Riley contacted me and said she's seeing something more. And she started describing situations that I knew about because they involved two Monroe City, Missouri boys who I mentioned earlier had vanished in February of 68 and June of 1977, mere months before Gacy was arrested in 78. And she had no way of knowing the facts that I knew because I'd looked into this, because it was an odd coincidence that, you know, after the Lost Boys of Hannibal vanished, two other boys had been missing or would be missing. So I looked at it and she identified the scenarios surrounding the disappearance of both of these boys, John Wagner and Ricky Enochs. And in the case of John Wagner, he went downtown Monroe City on a Friday night to get an ice cream cone and was talking with friends and got into a fight with another boy who thought John was putting the moves on his girlfriend. And John fell and hit his head. And the story kind of goes cold there. And he was never seen again. Ricky Enochs was last seen leaving his house in June of 77. And his father said, he went out the front door and said, I'm going to talk to a guy about a job. And went out and got in a car, a large sedan with Illinois plates. And Gacy drove a large sedan at the time, an Oldsmobile, and with Illinois plates, obviously. And Gacy often used as an entree to befriend boys, the promise of a job. And he promised that he'd pay more than anyone else in the area. And so, you know, kids were eager to make a few bucks and would get in the car and go to a restaurant with him. And then that would be the end of it. You know, big picture in the Hannibal area, five boys went missing in a fairly narrow time period in the 60s and 70s. And John Wayne Gacy is psychically connected to all of them.
Yeah, that's pretty astounding. Hard to dismiss that overwhelming amount of, even though it is circumstantial, or I don't even know if we can call it that legally, right? But it is an overwhelming preponderance of mediumistic and psychic evidence to this case. The books are out and available right now. We have a link for both books in today's program guide, The Lost Boys of Hannibal, Inside America's Largest Cave Search. And Souls Speak is the follow-up. Missing Children Reveal Their Serial Killer from Beyond. Did each one of the mediums also come into contact with Gacy's spirit about this case? I know that you said one of them did. I can't recall if you'd mentioned that all three believe that Gacy made his presence known.
Gacy made his presence known to Brittany, the psychic in Hannibal, and then the Wyoming psychic, Mary. And they both described him as kind of cocky. And oddly, they said he was repentant and he was wanting, to be freed of this judgment that he's under eternally. And I don't understand how this can happen, because clearly Gacy is in hell. And they stand by their story. These are, reputable Christian women who have helped police solve other cases before. And it's just a mystery. And I have a whole chapter in the book about this psychic phenomenon from a Christian perspective. And I kind of remain unconvinced at this point. That's why I think it's so important to dig and to look in the precise spot identified by Mary Reilly, so we know. And I come down, it's either a divine work that God is leading these women to finally resolve this case, or it's mean-spirited evil by demonic entities from the other realm. Because as a pastor friend of mine said, the demons that infiltrated Gacy's body know all the facts of the case and can, utter them in great detail. So that's where we come down. Is it a work of God or just mean-spirited tricksters trying to sow more sadness and despair?
Right. Wow. Very, very chilling, heartbreaking story. I hope this gave some resolve. Did family members, survivors of this, I know you said the parents are all gone, but did the surviving family members that, are still with us, how do they feel about the story? Have you spoken much with them?
Oh yeah. I've spoken with family members of the Hoags, and they're quoted extensively in the books. They've grown weary over the years of all the attention without having any resolution to the case. And I certainly understand that. I was always very sympathetic with them, because their lives were never the same again. The Hoags, they had, I think, 11 children, and were a well-known family in Hannibal because the father ran Hoag's Tavern, which was a family-friendly place where you could go and have dinner and or lunch. And they were well-known for their homemade pies and their meatloaf and their enchilada plates. And it was a well-known eatery. And they were a beloved family. And the family suffered other sadness in future years. An older brother was killed in a car accident in one of the Carolinas. And another son, distraught over a girlfriend breakup, brought a rifle to the playground across from Stoll School and just half a block from the Hoag's house, and shot himself in the mouth and killed himself right there on the playground. So terrible calamity, terrible sadness, terrible pain for this Hoag family over the years. And there's mean spiritedness that after the boys went missing, there was a rumor that got started that Mr. Hoag had killed the boys and buried them in the basement of their home. And at some point, police even, reluctantly said, look, we've got to look. So they went downstairs, and none of the dirt had ever been it was a silly, one of those terrible mean-spirited rumors that get circulated. And so it's been a painful chapter for so many people, including myself. I mean, I have thought about the Lost Boys a lot. And when I first decided to write the book, when I was up on Lover's Leap that day, about 20 years ago, it was one of those defining moments where, I said, we've got to remember this story and we have to remember the Lost Boys.
Well, thank you for being that voice for them and keeping them alive and keeping their story alive, John. It's important. And as the father of 11 children myself, I can tell you every soul, every person is important and they should be remembered. And I'm glad that somebody has taken the story seriously and was willing to, even in the face of logic, explore different aspects and elements of this story that might finally tie up the loose ends and get the answers that the family sought. So thank you so much for doing that and for spending some time with us here today, John.
Thank you, Dave. I appreciate it.
Powerful story. I mean, again, growing up in Illinois area, Tim, and hearing that case break with John Wayne Gacy, and that every hour it seemed there was more bodies being recovered, and the story just became more and more horrific. And of course, we've covered the show through the years, or covered Gacy's case through the years, and even had one of his survivors call into the show back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
It's astounding and makes you wonder just how long this man's career truly was, and how prolific, and what other mysteries still remain out there that have not yet been attributed to John Wayne Gacy.
You really wonder how deep that evil cavern is when you sit back and hear that more and more is mined out of that with every year that passes.
Yeah, no doubt. We hope you enjoyed today's program of True Crime Tuesday. And remember, if you'd like the full episode with the Dumb Crime Stupid Criminals aspect, all you have to do is go over and subscribe now for Stitcher Premium. Use code word Darkness Radio, all one word, to get some deep discount savings for your 1 year subscription. And it will give you access to all of our archives from Darkness Radio. There's over 1,000 episodes up and available, and more being added constantly. You get all of the episodes of True Crime Tuesday, and you get all of the other great programs that are part of Stitcher. Hundreds of thousands of hours of programming for $5 a month, commercial free. You can't beat that, so don't even try. Go subscribe now, and remember to use keyword Darkness Radio for those key savings.